Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. The weather has been actually quite pleasant for a change, although, as you can see, plain on my face, I got the worst of the sunburn for this year, I guess. But it's all downhill from here, so I guess it's just going to be like that. And with us tonight, we have renowned attorney to the stars, Mr. Richard Hauck, coming to us from lovely Ohio. How are you doing, Rich?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. My face does that thing, right, when you press, it's red, but then it's white. And Mrs. Jovi has been infinitely entertained, but my neck does it too. But I am, on the whole, actually quite okay with it. I'm fine with this.
It doesn't look too bad. It just looks like you got a little color, a little sun.
Yeah. Yeah, I did catch a lot of sun. It's good for you, I hear. I hear some people also tan their private parts. I have not yet tried that.
Oh, you should try it. Yeah. Mm. It's good. You should make sure you walk around barefoot while you do it, too.
I do not walk around barefoot. I do walk around in flip-flops.
You have to try the barefoot thing. It's like a ground. It's called earthing or grounding. It's something about, you know, the magnets in your feet.
Magnets. Wow. Well, it's
if it's complicated. I'm just kidding. There's no magnets in your feet, I don't think. I'm not a doctor, though. But
there isn't?
There is something to it, I believe. You can read about it if you like search grounding or earthing or whatever, but I think there's something to it.
Maybe if I'm in the country, I do live in a major urban agglomeration, so there's always the risk,
yeah,
right, on stepping on some you know, last year I stepped on a jagged piece of plastic and it went right through my slipper, right through my flip-flop. Ooh. I pulled it out myself, but apparently it was nasty, so it got a little infected. So it was a whole production. So I'm not going to do it if I'm not somewhere out in the countryside where I can be reasonably certain that there's no jagged pieces of modernity sticking up to be entered into my feet. So there's that, I guess. And as for the sunning, my private parts, from what I understand, It's a new technique. It's a new approach to sunbathing. Maybe I'll try it on one of my more private hikes when I go off track, unless, of course, the wildlife has something to say about it. The wild boars, the bears, the wolves, the foxes. I'm a little worried that a fox might start considering my private parts to be an excellent meal. But this is the Writer's Block. It's a classy, it's a fine show where we discuss very important intellectual subjects. And we are here to discuss Yukio Mishima's My Friend Hitler. And that's a snazzy and very edgy title. Oh, you're being friends with his Hitler.
It is a very attention-grabbing title. I've had the book on my shelf, and it's if you have the physical copy, it's kind of a it's pink. I wouldn't say bright pink. It's a bit muted, but it's very people notice it on your bookshelf. Like, it seems to be one, if people are ever like looking around, they always like My Friend Hitler. They always, you know, it's one that people gravitate to. Maybe they gravitate to it because they would like to be Hitler's friend, and it's very taboo in modern society. But I don't know. It is something that is very attention grabbing right off the title.
Yeah, I think there is a reason for that. But first, before we delve into it, and it is a magnificent book, right? It's a magnificent play. I would very much love to see it put on. The director in me, the first time I read it, I yearn to put something like this on, right? To put on the show. But first, we got to get some very crass financial concerns out of the way. As people should know, regular readers will know, putting on these shows and in the future maybe a production of My Friend Hitler and other dissident dramatic plays will require a lot of money. It requires resources. You don't get to have revolution for free, from what I understand, or so I've been told by people experienced in these matters. So we are having a fundraiser over at Countercurrents. That means we are raising funds, as self-explanatory as that may sound. So you can donate to this fine production through Entropy and Cash App, and you can also use MoonPay to send us crypto. Now, if you're donating through Cash App, the percentage which Cash App takes is lesser than that of Entropy, but you don't really get to ask us question. And I don't know if the owners of Cash App are really our guys, whereas the owners of Entropy, well, the entire thing is built around sending people super chats. It was a response to demonetization on YouTube. It was beta tested by people who are in this, people like Jean-François Gariepy. And so, and of course, you can ask us questions using Entropy. They do take 15% cuts, so that's something to think about. But you get to ask me questions. You get to ask Mr. Richard Howe question, right? And he's a renowned attorney. He is world famous. He can get you off if you're late on your alimony payments, from what I understand. Better call Rick.
I wouldn't go all that far, but thank you.
Right. Or maybe he'll specialize in elder law. I'm sorry. I've been watching a little too much. Better call Saul. And now you can also donate to us through DLive. You can send us lemons. You can send us the ice creams and ninjets and ninja genies and even the ever elusive diamonds. And you can give us library tokens over on Odyssey, because we are streaming on both DLive and Odyssey. And library tokens, they're a kind of cryptocurrency from what I understand. And unlike the other crypto, they seem to be rather stable. And so we would appreciate that. And also on Odyssey, you can even send us American dollars or maybe some other currency. I've yet to see non-American currency on Odyssey. Maybe this time it will be a first. Maybe this will be a first for the Odyssey Euro Super Chat. Maybe. And those are all the ways you can donate through and contribute to the Countercurrents fundraiser. And there is, of course, one last way. Those are all the direct ways. But the indirect way is you can go to alaskachaga.us and purchase some of their fine product. This is me slurping. For those of you listening to the audio replay, this is me slurping down some Alaska Chaga fine tea. They also got soaps. And I have been experimenting. I have been experimenting with cold chaga. And let me just tell you, people, this is that is the most divine smell, smelling tea I have ever had, or I will ever have in my life. The way things are going, I'm just looking forward to Alaska Chaga. Maybe nothing better will happen to me than Alaska Chaga, but it will be. It will be a good day. So I guess that's all of the crass financial concerns for today. I think that's all of the fundraising aspects of this thing of ours covered. Now, let's start with, our audience should know you by now, Mr. Hauk. We got a little ahead of ourselves, but for the people who may not know you, who may be late to this thing of ours, or maybe just tuning in for the first time, why don't you briefly introduce yourself? What do you do and what are you all about?
My name is Rich Hauk, and I write for Countercurrents, written for some other places back in the day. I write a lot about, I'm really interested in social capital, kind of the little things in your everyday life that I think makes the quality of life or makes the quality of your life good or bad, or either way. And I like riding my bicycle and bodybuilding. And I rescue cats. I really like 90s cars. And, not too fond of things like diversity and progressivism. And I like stuff like My Friend Hitler. That's about it. Thanks for. I happen to have a law degree and a law license, but whatever. I don't. That was sort of like a hobby on side of writing racist things for Countercurrents.
Yeah. It is a bold attempt to beat the Jews at their own game. Of course, we do forget that the law used to be something very important, very sacred to European civilization, and we have allowed our enemies to co-opt that area of expertise, to co-opt that area of civilization. And I guess we are paying the price right now for it. As like you, I'm also a lawyer, and I mean by education, I haven't worked as a lawyer in 2 years, I guess, because I was just sick of the way in which something as noble as the law was being perverted for ignoble ends. And of
Yes.
course, you realize that in a corrupt world, there are very little, a few ways in which a brash young man can really succeed in such a mature and corrupt field.
I think it's very interesting to be a lawyer in that you can navigate modern society a lot better. I know, like, just since I've been out of law school. Even really, even during law school to a degree and out of it, some legal things have come up for people around me, or people have asked me to do some things to help them out with a business or whatnot. And it's just so much easier to navigate. Or when I go to a county building office and I need an inspection or some variance, or somebody needs help with something, and that once they know you're a lawyer, they also are much easier to deal with, whether or not they're a lawyer. People like bend over backwards to help you out with it. They don't try to bullshit you so much about telling you, oh, well, the code says this. You can say, well, I just read the code and here's the exception. Let me get on my way now, please. It just so it even if you're not practicing, they call people who don't practice anymore recovering lawyers, which is very nice. It's a helpful thing to have to navigate for yourself and friends and family. And I think that's really was the ultimate drive for me to go to law school. I was never obviously interested in working for like Goldstein and Fink LLP or what some big law firm or anything of that nature. So just having that kind of in your quivers is just very helpful in the day to day. And I get a lot of calls from people who they might it might not be if they didn't know a lawyer, they might not take the time to find one and pay a consultation fee and whatnot, but they just bounce some questions off me, and it just makes everybody's life a little bit easier, I think. So I think that's worth something, even if it's something small. I think that's kind of, for me, it was worth the cost of admission anyway.
That's very interesting. I mean, it is obviously true. We are living in a contentious and conflicting world, but it's still a battle of words. It's still a battle of, legal. It's still a battle which has some precedence of to legality. And so, someone who actually speaks that language and can navigate that world is invaluable. And of course, I mean, your commentary recently with recent Supreme Court decisions. I think you made this point on Telegram that there is still a way in which we can use legal arguments to shake things around. Judges are still responsive to that and less responsive to leftist intimidation, maybe, than previously assumed. Would you like to briefly comment on that before we get into
Oh, yeah,
the
sure. I was
yeah.
basically commenting on the way the procedure works of laws and changing precedent. And essentially what I was getting at is that when you have a whole bunch of these Warren Court decisions, Roe v. Wade being one of them, Brown versus Board being another, Shelley versus Kramer, and on, you have all these Warren Court decisions, and they were basically decided before they got in front of the court. So the idea, what I mean by that is, they would say, "Hey, we want school integration, we want housing integration, we want abortion to be taken away from the hands of the states and federalized or constitutionalized." And then Warren and his justices would kind of figure out the legal argument needed to make that work, and they were all very weak. In my opinion, in a lot of people's opinion, that's not just my kind of like political my opinion because I dislike the political outcomes of it. Even people who are very much in favor of civil rights, the Civil Rights Act, they'll look at that and say, that's, you know, a pretty shaky foundation to use the Commerce Clause in this way. And then especially after there was a 1995 case, the Lopez was the name of the case, and I think it was 1995, might have been a little after. Anyway, at some point, there was a case dealing with the Gun-Free School Zone Act, and the court really limited the Commerce Clause, and people, you know, were kind of shaken up about it because they thought, oh, if the Commerce Clause is limited, this is going to cut at the heart of civil rights legislation and whatnot. And it hasn't been revisited. But the point is, it could be. People could say, you know, if for example, if you were very agnostic on abortion, whether it was right or wrong or good or bad, you could still make a very compelling argument that Roe v. Wade was an incorrect legal decision. And same thing, like I could argue that the Fair Housing Act and the Civil Rights Act are abuses of the Commerce Clause from a strictly Commerce Clause point of view, having nothing to do with my views of racial integration or forcing companies to associate with people they'd prefer not to associate with. But you can make that argument. And that's what I was getting at is, and people are receptive to these arguments. People like professional jurists who are into these sort of things, like Supreme Court justices tend to be. And if you have them, if they're a little bit sympathetic to your cause politically, and you can get them very sympathetic to a certain legal idea, which a lot of them are. They were all very sympathetic to getting rid of Roe v. Wade for one reason or another, and they had to have some legal reasoning to do that. And that's sort of how the job gets done. People, you know, I don't know. Some people didn't understand it, but that's okay. They don't have to. There's people I went to law school with, and I'm reading their Facebook posts, and it's apparent they didn't understand any of it either. So, you know, I wouldn't expect randoms on Telegram to get it, I guess.
Well, somebody's graduating at the bottom of classes. It's like Seinfeld says, every doctor you get rid that gets recommended, he's the best. But who's graduating at the bottom of the class? Some lawyers are incredibly dumb, right? Some don't even understand the law. Yeah, normies, like people who are not lawyers, they will sometimes assume that just because you have a degree, you understand the law. But many times I've found out it's embarrassingly not so. You got people who don't even read their case files. They got law degrees and they're working in law because most of the time, you know, it's on rails, right? You do the thing yeah. That's in front of you. And you learn as you go, you play it by ear. There's a lot more of that in law than people assume. And I'm not saying I don't do it or didn't when I was practicing law. I just did it less, I guess. I had more like a developed framework of doing things. And that alone put me a little bit above the rest here in lovely Macedonia. And I'm sure this is true the world over. I think that human nature isn't all that much different. If you're talking about people of the same race, especially, you know, white people, we're the same. And it's just one of those things, I guess. We are living in a declining civilization, and the quality of every profession is declining. But this is also very good, important to hear. I mean, it gives us an important weapon in this fight for white well-being, for you know, basically defending the interests of white people in America and the world over. And of course, it gives us an in with the people we'd like to call normies, right? We point to our enemy's flagrant disregard for the written law, and people just feel insecure when people in power act without regard to the law. That is the dictionary definition of tyranny, really. If you go back to Aristotle and his theories on politics, a tyrant, it's not someone who's a dictator or authoritarian. A tyrant is someone who rules in violation of the law or with no regard for the law. You could have a very authoritarian government, which is completely legal, which is completely free of tyranny, because it actually follows the law. Its decisions make sense, legally speaking, morally speaking, and it's the law is important to people. That's and that's important to note. These things are important to people, and people will fight to preserve them. And that could be an in if you're engaging in debates with normies, if you're an ambassador to the normies. Understand that people do not like living under tyranny. Tyranny is legal chaos, and nobody likes living under legal chaos. Let's move into Mishima. We got 20 minutes talking about your adventures in Lawyerland and how you've single-handedly going to defeat the Warren Court and all of its illegal decisions. So let's get into My Friend Hitler. It's a 1968 play by Mr. Yukio Mishima, and it's about, the events preceding the Night of the Long Knives, the purge of the Sturmabteilung, the SA, as imagined by Mr. Yukio Mishima. Rich, why don't you give us a brief introduction to this literary work?
It is, I didn't mention anything the first time you said it, but I actually went, after I read it, I went and looking for a production of it to see if there was a video of a production of it or anything, because I too would have loved to have seen it. Having somebody, do a current production would be fantastic. The idea, kind of the background here, is we are early in Hitler's career in Germany, and early, what are we, 1934 or something like that, shortly after his election. And you have only four characters in the entire play. You have Hitler, Ernst Röhm, Gregor Strasser, and Gustav Krupp. So you have Strasser, who's sort of the socialist wing, the more left wing of the party.
The Nazbol. Yeah, he's the OG national Bolshevik, the OG Nazbol, Gregor Strasser.
And then you have Ernst, who's running, Ernst Röhm, running the SA at the time. And he had grown the SA from a very small group of men to about 3 million. Then you have Gustav Krupp, who's an industrialist. And that's it. You just have those four people in three acts, and a couple different scenes that to me, if you imagine them, were very beautiful, especially like when you have Hitler and Röhm talking about kind of their time in war together, and I'm a soldier, you're an artist, and those sort of back and forth, really getting into their friendship and their history together, is very beautiful. So what is being portrayed throughout this play is, well, should we start? You want to start with like a plot somewhere? How do you want to do it from here?
Well, it's a character driven play, but the characters are also stand-ins for ideology, for the stage directions. And this is the thing, right? Because we've read it, you actually read the stage directions too. And there would be, of course, these subtleties will be evident in a stage production. But always, Ernström, he always stands to Hitler's right, and Gregor Strasser always stands to Hitler's left. Whereas Mr. Gustav Krupp, the industrialist, he prefers to stay in the shadows. So even when he's on stage, he's a small presence. He's a frail old man. Mm-hmm. And but he's always, always, always somewhere behind Hitler. He's following him like a shadow. And this is something that's been observed. It's observed by Strasser in the play. So it is a very interesting a study of character. And if you even look at it, realistically speaking, you can even see the outlines of various factions of the dissident right personified by these men, by Ernst Röhm, by Gregor Strasser, by Hitler, even by Mr. Gustav Krupp, mm-hmm. right? Because we are talking about the OG Nazbol, people are trying very hard to revive national Bolshevism and really marry nationalist ideology, the nationalist position, to socialist economic policies. And we're not even talking about the old school socialism as in living together type attitude, which is actually very common among Germans historically and today. We are talking about actual socialism, actual state ownership and operation of the economy and its productive capacities. This is something that's evident in the play. It's evident in the history of the National Socialist Party. It had a left wing which thought the nationalism should be secondary to the socialism. And of course, it had a right wing which was primarily nationalist and only saw the socialist bit as instrumental to achieving the end of nationalism. And now we have these conflicts within our own movement as well. These conflicts are, I guess, we are doomed as nationalists to have them for as long as there is nationalism.
I think, yes, all that is very interesting. And the way it worked in the play, as you were saying, you had these characters representing, since, you know, you brought it up about the left wing and the right wing, Hitler's position. You have Krupp sort of in the background. And you even have a very interesting last line about getting rid of the left and the right. So Krupp is talking to Hitler and he says, you've cut down the left and you turned your sword back and cut down the right. So Rahm and his military and sort of all being a professional soldier and career military man are representing the harder right-wing faction when he's talking about cutting down the right. And then Hitler says, yes, government must take the middle road. So we see that saying exactly what you're saying as these one character representing more left, one more right. And then you have the old frail industrialist who's always with a cane, struggling to walk at times, struggling to sit up properly, and sort of always in Hitler's ear, always kind of pursuing him to take this more middle of the road approach. But it wasn't just, you know, Krupp being the bad guy. He was also sort of saying, hey, they might be planning something against you. You know, there might be something going on here, and which was true, especially on Strasser's part. And I guess if we want to get into the theme of friendship, which, you know, kind of the name, its namesake comes from, is, you know, Strasser is telling Rahm that Hitler's going to kill him. And he's saying, no, he's my friend. We go back many years. There's no way. And there's quite a bit of dialogue in Act Two. We see Strasser and Rahm going back and forth, Strasser arguing for, and another thing you kind of see in the socialist aspect, Strasser wants, you know, he said, okay, there's been one revolution done, you know, being that we're kind of out of the Weimar period into this new era. And he's saying, yes, but we need another revolution. And you're seeing this idea of permanent revolution and kind of constant progress coming out of the way Strasser's talking about everything.
Maybe that's not the point, because when Strasser is speaking about the revolution, he's really pitching the idea of a coup to Ernst Röhm. And so you have to, I mean, obviously there is the idea of permanent revolution, and we can see that Strasser is a guy who just cannot take a W, right? He cannot take a win.
Yes.
The National Socialist Party has won, but we've got people like Gustav Krupp, who's one of the most powerful industrialists in Germany, and if not the most powerful industrialist in Germany, and he's kissing Hitler's ass. He's eating out of Hitler's hand. Yes, he follows him around, but it's not really... I think the final act, the act where Strasser and Rahm are already dead and Krupp and Hitler are discussing what's to be done, what they have done, the power dynamic is very obviously shown that Hitler is holding the whip hand. The symbolism is particularly, it's very on the nose when Krupp drops his cane in shock when yes. Hitler asks him, are you giving me orders now, right? Krupp drops his cane. He cannot pick it up because he cannot bend over because he's an old man. And it was very clear to me, and then Hitler starts singing an old army song, but with great murder in his voice, with murderousness in his voice. It's pretty clear that Krupp is shaken to his very core. He thought he could maybe control this brash young chancellor, but no, government is going to subjugate large industry, as is the doctrine of fascism, as is the doctrine of national socialism. Government supersedes capital interests. It's not against them, but it is the boss of them. Whereas Strasser, you know, he expects these capacities to be completely nationalized. He just does not understand that, yeah, if capitalists start kissing your ass, that's it. You've won.
Right.
You are in command now.
And the way, when you said he's like a guy who just cannot take his win and move on, and he wants. So, yes, I thought of it sort of in two ways, as you, you were saying, you know, you think about the next revolution being the coup against Hitler. And to me, I get, you know, of course that is there. And I thought it was just this, Strasser is continually to advocate for more, which is exactly what you're saying. We can't just take his win and move on. It's not good enough. We need to do more. And they're arguing, you know, back and forth with Strasser and Rahm about, you know, if we team up, maybe we can make it out alive. But Hitler's going to kill us if we don't kill him, and he's going through all this. And then you see quite a bit of Ernst Röhm saying, no, this, you know, we're old friends. We go way back. And that song you were saying, I believe at one point, Röhm and Hitler are singing it together, right? In Act One. And then he's kind of singing, is that the same song that he's singing to Krupp later on?
Yeah, but it's a dark reprise when Röhm and Hitler are singing it. It's a jolly soldier's jaunt. Mm-hmm. Like you imagine it to be a marching tune.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me just bring up my copy of the book here because I have it in electronic form. I don't have a paper copy. It is unfortunate because you are right. A book like this you should have in paper copy. But we make do here at the Writer's Block. It is a living. It's some sort of living. Okay, let's see. Act two, when they sing the song. In death, let us be together. Let's fight together with gun in hand. In battlefield, poppies in bloom, blazing our chests. And as our friends from the United Kingdom will know, poppies in bloom symbolize the sacrifice of young men during the First World War, because, well, the poppies in bloom, they are blood red. You cannot mistake them for any other flower. And of course, in the battlefields of World War I, all vegetation was ruined except for the poppies. The vibrations of the shells brought their seeds to the surface after having been buried for so many years. And you can always tell where an artillery battle has been fought on the Western Front in Europe because the poppies are in bloom. I expect we will observe similar phenomena in Ukraine when the war is over there, because that war has been heavy on artillery, which is another thing that should be addressed. The pathology of Strasser is that he cannot accept that he has won. He has to agitate. It's stronger than him. He's probably one of these people who would be unhappy, whatever the society. If he were in Moscow, right? If he were in Moscow in 1933, he would be a Trotskyite. He would say that Stalin didn't go far enough. But the pathology of Ernst Röhm is he likes to play soldier, and he never really got over the nostalgia for the sense of meaning he had during the First World War. And basically, he built up his Sturmabteilung not as a means to an end, but as a means to a sort of living out his youthful delusions. He is maybe the ultimate nostalgia politician, Mr. Ernst Röhm.
Yes, he might be. And that was, in many ways, you see that throughout the play as a perhaps a weak point, or maybe his downfall, because he was building up the SA, building it up. People were starting to be threatened of it because of the amount the power that he had controlling the SA, how large it was growing, and also that he kind of, even though Strasser was wrong about some things, he was right that, you know, Hitler might have been coming for him, coming for his life, and he was always hearkening back to the good times when his friendship with Hitler, and he's saying, no, that can't be, you know, what you're saying cannot be true, this is crazy. And, you know, we were good friends. We have all this history together. Why would this happen? But Strasser ended up being right in that sense. And it seemed there was, a bit about the contention between the SA and the regular army and what should be under whose control. And it almost seemed that Rome was aloof to that in a lot of ways. He was kind of just, like you said, kind of playing his military thing, kind of living out that role, maybe not realizing the political implications it was having in the current time.
And it is, historically speaking, the SA, they did beat the shit out of the Antifa of the time on the streets. Right then, the anti-fascist action, the Red Guards, the Red Bloc, whatever they call themselves in 1920s and 30s Germany, they were a genuine threat to the Weimar Republic. They were a threat to the German people. They were a threat to business owners. These were radical communists, agitated from Moscow, from wherever. There was, of course, the attempt to establish a Bavarian social republic, a Bavarian Soviet republic, which was snuffed out by the Freikorps. And the SA were instrumental in bringing these people to heel, but they were also thuggish. And this is alluded to in the play that essentially the SA has taken to kidnapping people for ransom, to basically beating up guys for the purpose of stealing their girlfriends, intimidation, racketeering. They're acting more like a criminal gang at this point than anything else. And, you know, who can blame them? They're an army with no enemy and no battle to fight. So they got to get bored. This is all alienating, not just the regular army, not just the Reichswehr. It is also alienating the German population, and it might be costing Hitler legitimacy if he cannot bring this violence to heel. He is, of course, the compromise candidate. He is the candidate who will bring peace to Germany. This is how he was elected in 1933. In 1934, his grip on power is still not complete, right? It's... So that's the kind of environment in which they were operating. But Ernstrom refuses to acknowledge these things.
He doesn't see it. Real. Yeah, he never sees it. You have all of that going on, the contention, the way the SA is acting, it bothering a lot of Germans, people wanting something to be done about it. And he just kind of continues to... relive the good days, talk about how small it was and how he's increased it by such a significant margin. And at one point he says, you know, it was the few people we started with, now over 3 million, I've increased it over tenfold in the last few years. And he's kind of just plays up the good aspects of it and what good having the SA could do, but then totally oblivious and aloof again to what's happening and why the SA is starting to basically kind of produce some negative capital going around for himself especially, but also for Hitler, of course, which is leading to, essentially leading to part of the Long Knives and Night of the Long Knives and something people saying, hey, we need to do something about these people. What's it going to be? And then that's the kind of the solution to it later on.
Yeah. It's interesting because when we are introduced to Ernstrom and he begins arguing with Gustav Krupp, he has this contempt for him because Krupp is a capitalist, because Krupp, you know, he's not part of the revolution. And Ernstrom also has that, he is presented as the right wing, right? He's to Hitler's right in the stage directions, but he's also a revolutionary. He really describes the essay as a mechanism which will dredge up the bottom of an ocean to dig up a bigger canal He describes really the reactionary aspects of society as stale. He numbers Krupp, Gustav Krupp, and Krupp works, the industrial power of Germany, the German industrial set, as Tim Murdoch would call them. He numbers them among these reactionary elements. And he also rails very hard against the Prussian establishment, as he puts it, right, as at the establishment of the Reichswehr, of the German army. And, well, maybe these people were stolid and they needed some revolutionary energy to get them moving again. But one gets the sense that Ernst Röhm is motivated in his hatred of the Reichswehr and of the Prussian aristocratic set because they snubbed him at the officers' club when he was a captain in the German army in World War I. There is essentially, he has a personal vendetta against the army, and it's letting this personal vendetta cloud his judgment with regard to the army's objections about the SA's activities. That's something we should take into account. So we're going to be getting back on track by reading out some of the super chats. And we have 10 American dollars on Entropy from Sumchan. And we know Sumchan. We love Sumchan. She's a regular. So she says, the keeper of double is a god amongst men.
Jeez.
That is all.
Okay. Doing too much.
Yeah. This is some cryptic message. Maybe it's for our friend here with the law degree. I understand nothing of it. And we have another 10 American dollars from Friedrich, who just says, cheers. Well, cheers to you, mate. And thank you for your donation. Thank you for being a fan. Thank you for being you. What can I say? I just watched a very interesting video on Romania. And what can I say? I've been thinking about visiting. Let's see. We got 5 lemons from Hapa Perspective. Now, for those of you who don't know, Hapa Perspective has begun streaming video games on DLive, and he streams for 2 hours just before the writer's block, so you can seamlessly transition from Hapa Perspective gaming to the writer's block. As I have, in fact, just before this show started, I was watching Hapa Perspective play. I forget the name of the game, but it's a very realistic military squad-based type game. And he was playing as some unnamed Eastern European militia fighting against Canadians, and he completely smoked those Canucks. He had roast moose for supper. He ate all of their maple juice and did some very unspeakable things to their beavers. So you all just go sub to Hapa Perspective on DLive and enjoy his gaming streams, because I enjoy them. And you're also going to get some good commentary. They're surprisingly realistic, so you might learn a thing or two about small unit tactics. So I guess, okay, that's all of the Entropy donations. That's all of the DLive donations. Okay, we have 5 American dollars. I just refreshed the page. 5 American dollars from ABC. And he says, a team led by Davis R. Began of the University of Toronto Department of Anthropology suggested that human ancestors evolved in Europe millions of years ago, not Africa. So the out-of-Africa theory of human evolution is out the window. Thoughts? Well, Rich, have you got any thoughts on that?
On the out-of-Africa theory?
Yeah, and it's apparently being thrown out in anthropological circles.
Why are they throwing it out?
Well, because David R. Began of the University of Toronto apparently uncovered evidence that humans evolved in Europe millions of years ago and not in Africa.
Hmm. Yeah,
you got any thoughts on that?
I think that's interesting because people. I mean, there's been all sorts of evidence of human remains found in Europe, predating any humans found in Africa, and it's sort of been kind of widely known, especially in our circles, and It's just interesting to see the mainstream kind of catching up with this in a way, or to see them abandoning it. Like they don't abandon like Boasian anthropology, even though everybody knows all of Franz Boas's studies were completely fabricated. So it's really interesting to see them trying to abandon the out of Africa theory, which is cool because it well, hope I don't know what to do with it. They probably won't make the correct logical leaps from it, but it seems like they might. Well, it could undermine this idea that we're all one race, or that this, especially that we came from Africans and they were the Earth's original people, and all that goofy stuff.
Personally, I think that the whole out of Africa thing is based on the evidence which was available at the time, and now new evidence is coming in. This is not going to hurt Boasian anthropology. It's ultimately my quibble with anthropology and evolutionary history is not whether humans came out of Africa or out of Europe. But the nature of human beings today, the nature of the human animal, how its intelligence, its impulse control, criminality, all of these factors vary across races, between races, and where we came from originally as a species, less important. I mean, I've seen some of the evidence. It's pretty compelling that, yeah, maybe the first hominids we could call Homo sapiens, I mean, the first hominids may have arisen in what is today Bulgaria, but it could go either way. So I think that we should consider the question well answered. Rich, now we have no donation accompanying this issue, but I see the chat is very agitated about it, so I'm gonna have to ask you to address it on stream, Rich. There has apparently been a case of the state of Illinois stripping a lawyer from his license for being
He
a
didn't have it
quote-unquote.
yet. It was after the bar. He was applying to get the license.
So apparently I'm talking about Matthew F. Hale, who was denied license. So he was not stripped of a law license. He was denied license to practice law. And people are claiming in chat that it was because he was a white nationalist or maybe a white supremacist, whereas you disagree with that position. If you would just elucidate your
Yeah, I've
position.
had people argue this my entire time in law school, saying, "Oh, you're not going to get a law license because Matt Hale didn't." You know, it was nonstop. Why even go to law school? Matt Hale couldn't get a license. Bob, they're just going to do what Matt Hale did. It's nonstop from people, and obviously, it's still nonstop. And you know, people will say, "Oh, you couldn't have got a law license. Matt Hale didn't get hit." It just the issue wasn't a pure free speech issue. The organization, the World Church of the Creator, that Matt Hale was in charge of at the time of him applying for a law license in Illinois, had come under a lot of heat for various crimes, including murder, within the preceding 10 years. Members of the organization, I don't know too much about that case, but it appears that they did murder people, or at least somebody. So members of the church organization that Matt was leading. And if you are the leader of any organization and they look into that and they see it has a history of crimes and murder, you're going to have a hard time getting a law license. There's somebody I went to law school with that 20 years that they went back to law school much later in life after they had grown children. 20 some years before they went to sit for the bar, they had some very small criminal activity that was gang affiliated. It amounted to basically selling small amounts of marijuana and you know, paying a woman for sex or some prostitution. And they were having they had to spend years trying to convince the ethics committee to allow them to have a law license, because in their past there was some criminal activity. If you're a part of an organization that has criminal activity, they're going to call your character and fitness into question. Would it have mattered if he was a left, far left wing agitator and had was part of an organization that had criminal history? Yeah, probably. They probably would have been more sympathetic to it, as they generally are, because there's this a liberal anti-white hegemony in the United States. So it's not untrue that him being pro-white and anti-Semitic didn't do him any favors. But this idea that it was just purely speech isn't true. Anytime you lead an organization of any sort, you're going to be under heightened scrutiny under the character and fitness board review. And the fact that, you know, they're worried that, hey, he might know a bunch of people who've committed a bunch of crimes and he just wants to be a lawyer to help out his friends. That's a legitimate concern for any organization, and it's always going to raise a huge red flag.
So basically the standard of, let's not call it guilt, but the standard of these certification boards, the bar associations, is actually much lower than that of a criminal court. Criminal court is, you know, beyond shadow of a doubt. This is, you're in the same, let's say, chess club with, as a guy who deals weed. You're already suspect, which is, sure. I guess a bar organization can afford to have a much lower standard of basically denying.
Yeah, that could make you suspect. I had another guy I knew. He dropped a few classes. He was failing a few classes in undergrad, dropped some, started law school, dropped out his first year, went back to law school, ended up graduating. He had a hell of a time getting through the character and fitness certification issue because they were essentially worried he would take on projects and not finish them. And I said, hey, you have a history of dropping classes and dropping out and coming back. Are you going to, you know, what are you going to do with your legal practice? They were worried about that. It's very weird. It's kind of bizarre. The rules are written, but the things that you see come up, almost anything can red flag it. And this idea that, because in the 90s in Illinois, Matt Hale was denied a law license, it just is pervasive and comes up over and over and over as an excuse of like, oh, well, we can't do anything because Matt Hale tried and they didn't give him a license. So don't go to law school. Don't go to med. Just don't do anything. Sit in your bedroom and yell about Jews all day. It's just absurd.
Before we put this matter to rest, Rich, wasn't your own license to practice under threat in Ohio State at one point, and you survived that? Your license survived this threat.
My license has survived complaints. Yes.
So basically, Richard Hauck has a book out there called "Unmasking Liberalism" under his own Christian name. He has many articles for Countercurrents. Some of the most widely read articles on Countercurrents are Richard Hauck's. He's certainly someone I look up to. I want to write like him one day, if possible. He has his own show. He's been on this show. This is the first time that Rich has been on the reworked Writer's Block, but he has been before when we were co-hosting with Full Moon Ancestry. We had great fun.
We did.
Right. I think we got seriously drunk last time you were around. Maybe. I don't remember. I was drunk like the whole of 2020. I fell into some pretty bad habits, old habits that year. But yeah, this is someone who is very openly pro-white, anti-Semitic, counter-Semitic even, who wants white people to remain a majority in their historic homelands, and yet he's out there practicing law. He's out there practicing law, taking names in Ohio State. And so, yeah, we're still not at this stage where we're being thrown into feeding camps and all of the other nastiness. We can still fight back in the legal arena, and I want to salute Rich for doing it.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate that. It means a lot. Yeah.
Well, I'm just glad to be able to give you this platform to express yourself. We have donations on DLive from Slog. He has given us his 14 lemons, and that 14, I want to thank you for that, Slog, but that looks incomplete. Like it's part of a conceptual whole, which has to be finished off by a second half to this conceptual whole, also consisting of digits, might be related to the title, to the subject of today's stream. Who knows? And we, of course, we have an ice cream from Pterodactyl Beak Hat. That's a very creative name.
That's a good name. Course,
yeah.
I would like one of those.
Yeah.
A pterodactyl beak hat, that is.
Well, we have a fashion victim here, a gentleman, Mr. Hauk, in his pterodactyl beak hat, his black wife beater, and with his white cat, and he's strolling into court. And he's up. He's going to save the white race. He's going to use the dankest legal argumentation, or so I've been told, at the very least. Let's see if we got more entropy chats. If not, let's just jump back into... okay. We have 10 American dollars from Gadius Maximus, heroic moderator Gadius Maximus. He says, lawyer friend, there's a lot of legal stuff going on in the news. Can we have guns now and keep babies from dying now?
Yes, there's lots of stuff going on. Let's see, babies from dying. It is no longer a federal right or constitutional right at this point. So states might say you can kill your baby, but the federal government, the Supreme Court, at least at the Supreme Court, the federal government could, I guess, say you have a right. They could make it black letter law. And actually, Barack Obama promised to do that when he was running. In 2007, he promised to codify Roe versus Wade into black letter law, or try to make that happen. And obviously, he can't write the law, but he can, you know, pull around his presidential weight and try to make some things happen. Didn't happen. A lot of Democrat lawmakers have promised to do something similar. I think Biden may have as well. Never happened. Got struck down. People are losing their mind. It's going to be back to the states. The gun thing, I didn't read the gun case, about extending, so you had, what were the ones, you had, Heller versus DC McDonald versus Chicago, and those were interesting about guns in the house, and then you had, in your own house, I mean, and then they had this recent one, which is kind of reaffirming Second Amendment isn't just for the house. For your own house. So extending what we got in Heller and the McDonald cases, which is really cool. So that is a good thing. Oh, they struck down the very old New York City law, I believe. There's something, it was like 110 years old, and that just took a blow. They said, no, this is unconstitutional for the Second Amendment. Kavanaugh, I believe it was Kavanaugh. Was it Kavanaugh or was it Gorsuch? I think it was Kavanaugh. When before he was confirmed, so this could be Gorsuch, I think it was Kavanaugh, but it's one of the two, because I was in law school when it was going on, and they were saying that they believe that the Second Amendment was sort of a stepchild amendment, where you have, you know, a whole line of First Amendment cases, Fourth Amendment cases, Fifth Amendment cases, all these things in the Supreme Court, you know, huge jurisprudence kind of going every little direction of First Amendment, trying to really feel out the edges of First Amendment. And then Second Amendment, you have like two cases, you know, you have Heller versus DC, and it said you could keep guns in your house. And then you had Chicago versus McDonald, which made it, put it through the 14th Amendment. So it would apply everywhere. And he said, you know, I would like to kind of improve on this. And people are losing their minds at the time thinking like, he's going to go crazy and let all these Second Amendment cases come. He's going to destroy gun control. And, well, that might be what he's doing, which would be pretty cool if he actually came through on what he said he would do some years ago. And then the other case, there was a case about Miranda warnings. I've seen a lot of incorrect information going about that. Miranda warning is, so that case, that comes from a case, a man was arrested. His last name was Miranda. It was in the 60s. So that, you know, when you get arrested, well, if you've ever been arrested or seen an arrest on TV, and they say you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to an attorney, anything you say can be used against you. Okay, so two things about that. That saying, that the Miranda warning, those rights they read you, a lot of people think it has to be like a word-by-word verbatim kind of thing. It doesn't. The cops can just they can say as grug brain as possible. They can be like, look, you don't have to talk to us. If you need an attorney, you can get an attorney. I hate you. You're a scumbag. You're a piece of shit, but you don't have to talk to us. If you do talk to us, I might punch you in the mouth. They can like be, they can just be going totally off the head, losing their mind, giving this guy's rights, and that counts. Okay. So for one, it's not like a specific script you have to memorize. It's not like the Pledge of Allegiance. As long as they get some words in there about attorneys and not talking, you're good. Okay. So they read you your rights to let you know. The reason they do this is because there was violations of people's right to an attorney and right to remain silent happening. Cops were saying, you have to talk to us. You can't have an attorney till you talk to us, doing these sort of things, right? So they had this Supreme Court case in Miranda, and they said, you know what? You just have to give them a warning. They need to know somewhere of their rights. It's not fair to take these criminals off the streets who don't know anything. Most people don't know their rights, so they have to be read the rights, right? So this comes from that. So if those rights are violated, as in cops speak to you, or let's say they don't give you any warning and they just try to get you to talk, and without telling you, you don't have to talk, or they don't tell you you can have a lawyer or a free lawyer or whatever, right? If those rights are violated, there's a couple of things you can do. You can, one, try to have anything silly you said or without a lawyer thrown out if it goes to court, and you can sue the police for violating your rights. So this somebody tried to do that, and this case came up, and all it did, it clarified when a subject who's been arrested may sue somebody for the violation of their Miranda rights. And that's all the case is about. It didn't do away with the Miranda warning. It didn't do away with the ability to sue or to have evidence withheld if your Miranda rights were not read to you or violated or whatever. Mm-hmm. All it did was say, okay, well, in this case, your rights were not violated to a degree that you can sue. The example I use is, for example, let's say the cop doesn't tell you your rights, okay? Let's say nobody says, hey, you have the right to remain silent. But let's say you go ahead and remain silent anyway. They don't tell you to, but you do it anyway, right? You don't talk. Nothing's used against you because you didn't say anything. Well, you can't turn around and then sue the police for not reading you your Miranda rights that you had the right to remain silent if you were silent anyway, because you were not damaged from the rights not being read to you. If you were not aware that you had the right to remain silent, they asked you to talk, you talk, that damaged you, okay, then maybe you have a case. But if it just didn't come up, you can't sue them and saying, you should have read me my rights. Well, you weren't talking. It didn't make any difference. And the case is, from what I understand, was more of those lines of when you can and cannot sue the police for a rights violation.
Great. That makes sense because, I specialized in damage restitution. How can you claim damages if you have no damages?
Yes, right? Exactly.
It's like getting into a low velocity car accident, and yes, you hit the guy, but you don't significantly damage his car, right? How can he claim damages when he hasn't suffered damages?
Right. That's a great area of law that you were in, because you really understand like the line where everyone thinks because something happened that they didn't like that they might be able to sue. And it's like, well, what are the damages? So you understand, like, I'm sure that came up, a bunch of areas of law came up to that where you had to look like, okay, yeah, maybe technically you were violated, or maybe, you know, if you were assaulted, for example, somebody comes up and knocks your hat off your head. Yeah, you were assaulted, but it's like, what are your damages? You know, what are the damages for having to pick up your hat from the ground, or, you know, a small fender bender that actually didn't bend the fender even, or whatever.
Yeah, I was wondered about the terminology. I know what fender means, but what did they call it? A bender, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so they call it a fender bender because you get into an accident and it, like, your fender just gets crumpled a little bit.
I just thought that in America that they call the maybe the front or the rear bender, right? The rear fender, the bumper, they call it a bender or whatever, but no, apparently it's not.
Yeah, it just means you crumpled it. You did a little bit of damage to your fender. So all you did
Right.
was bend it, but it's still functional.
Right. I mean, it's these things, right? People think they can sue for stress. No, you can't sue for stress. You have to post actual damages, which can be assessed, right? It has to be measurable damage. I like doing that because it is in as much as the law can be an exact science, it is an exact science. Just going over damages. Two cars, two persons, two objects, two businesses. Reputation is another thing. Can you damage a reputation? Can you sue for defamation? These things, but it is a very precise. So yeah, that's actually very sensible that you cannot sue for violation of rights where you didn't really suffer any damage from the quote unquote violation of the
Yeah. Oh,
rights.
Thomas said that was battery, not assault. Someone flips your hat off your head, which I
Yeah,
guess it is.
Thomas Sto I think
Yeah.
Thomas is also a lawyer,
Yeah,
so
I
he
guess it
should
is. I
be,
guess if you were
right?
like, "Oh no, don't hit my hat," you were assaulted, and if they did hit your hat, you were battered. I
Right. It
yeah,
is
haven't done one of those ever kind of cases. So it just yeah, it's back from torts one. I've never actually had one come up in, practice.
I guess it's a variation on that trope, you know, when they in movies when they fight, not the hair. Well, this one is not the hat, and
Yeah.
I can understand the sentiments. I have some very fine hats,
Yeah, there you go.
which, yeah, I mean, like you punch me in the face, I'll get better in about a week, but you destroy my very fine and expensive hats. I'm not recovering from that in a jiffy because
Yeah.
I only really get the best handmade hats.
There you go. You might have some damages on your hands.
Yeah, that's actual damages. You don't just punch me in the face. I'm a young guy. I'm gonna regrow this eyeball, obviously. I'm like a lizard, I guess. But we do have a book to discuss, Richard. So
Let's
we
get
where
back
we
to
left off was Ernst Röhm is basically a kid. He likes to play soldier, and that's his problem, right?
Yes.
Let's move into one remarkable thing about this whole position of this reluctance of Ernst Röhm to just understand that he is also a kind of permanent revolutionary, even though he is portrayed as the right wing of the National Socialist Party. And he is a destabilizing influence because I guess he does not understand that politics and actually being at war is not the same as playing soldier. We are told time and time again that what he actually likes about the business of soldiering is marching around the brass band. Like he likes horsing around, so he likes the camaraderie of soldiery. But I don't think even he or anyone else for that matter likes the actual quote unquote storm of steel, the facing bullets and artillery. And people are talking about, oh, the heroism. And yes, I guess it is heroic to fight for your country, but it's not glorious. You got people, especially in modern warfare, you catch an artillery shell, you could be the baddest, toughest motherfucker out there. You t catch an artillery shell, you're going to get turned into pink mist. And people like Ernst Röhm, people who are, in a sense, permanent children, they cannot help but romanticize the soldier's life when it's actually a very difficult. And the reason we respect soldiers so much is because they take this immense burden upon themselves so that the rest of us don't have to. Yeah, any more thoughts on that?
No, I think you summed it up very well. That he really sort of liked the pomp and circumstance of soldiering. He liked the there is the romantic idea of it, of course, which is probably very attractive. But it is he just sort of wants that to go on forever, and that started to cause some political problems for the National Socialist Party.
Yeah. You cannot have these people. Like, I mean, I've been called a wingnut before, but here we are observing Ernst Röhm really taking the role of the wingnut a little bit. Someone who likes marching around in uniform a little too much. He's scaring the normies. He's presiding over this. He calls it an army, but it could as just as well be a gang of thugs, which is beginning to racketeer, to engage in racketeering, extortion, intimidation of civilians, right? We this is not just an abstract discussion or a historical discussion of the National Socialist Germany. These archetypes persist on the nationalist right to this day. I mean, we have in Gregor Strasser the Nazbol. He is the OG Nazbol. We have in Ernst Röhm this time something of the Wignat, right? And another aspect of it is we learn in the third act that Hitler always resented his condescension, right? That's something that I found very interesting. They were, of course, talking like old war buddies about the mouse who lived in
Oh yeah.
Rome's butt. I can you tell that story? It's a lovely story.
Yeah, that's a great one. There was a mouse that lived in an old boot on a shelf, and Hitler wanted to, they said we could get rid of the mouse, and Hitler says, no, let's keep the mouse. So they leave some food out for the mouse, and as they hang out late into the night talking in the office, the mouse sort of kind of pokes his head out a bit more. And he becomes friendlier, and they continue to feed him. And eventually, the mouse will come right up to them to the point where they can tie like a little bow around the mouse, like almost like a little collar, and then they'll write these write different names on it. And they have this mouse friend in the office. And they know it was the same mouse because they would tie these little bows on him, and they would never see a different mouse without the bow that they had written on. And that was a very, I really love that part of the story.
It is a heartwarming story. The mouse lives in Rome's old boot because when they were kicking the shit out of some communists, I love just the way he puts it. My old boot took this war wound so I wouldn't have to, right?
Yes.
So the boot was torn open from kicking the shit out of a communist, which is a heroic way for a boot to go. I wish all of my destroyed shoes had gone that way, but apparently they are all destroyed because I guess I walk 20, 25 kilometers every day, and modern capitalism does not produce shoes which can withstand that kind of continuous stress. And this is the reason why I'm walking around in flip-flops, because I cannot find a decent pair of shoes.
It's
I'm sorry,
understandable.
I'm getting emotional. This is an important subject to me. I have some my feet, they're like an unusual shape, so it's very difficult for me to find good shoes, and then they fall apart after 2 years. It's a whole production. In any case, this boot of Rome's is where they keep the mouse, and
This house.
because right and because they cannot decide on a name for the mouse, Ernst Röhm wants to call him Adolf, and Hitler wants to call him Ernst. They decide to name him Adorst, and that's that's actually pretty endearing in a dorky way. They really are friends, but all the while Hitler resented the condescension. Hitler did not like being treated like this, the little brother, like where Ernst said at one point, Ernst the soldier and Adolf the artist.
Yes.
I think there is the sense that Hitler always had this sense of resentment towards Ernst Röhm, to for his childishness, for his condescension, for this endless desire to just keep playing soldier until the bitter end. You ever get that? You get that feeling from the play, Rich?
I did not well I should I didn't until the artist bit came up on the soldier to the artist, and it almost made him, sort of not quite emasculated, but sort of like, oh, you're the dandy, I'm the real man, you're kind of the dandy. And there was that aspect of it, and it was you could see why, Hitler might take exception to that. He, I think the thing started out, the whole play started out him talking about his time in World War One, and he was quite the soldier. He wasn't just sitting at a desk somewhere. He was in the trenches. He was getting injured. He was dragging guys out off the battlefield. And this idea of, oh, you're just the, you're the sensitive one. You're the artist. You do start to get this sense. I don't know if it's a full, resentment that I picked up on, but there was at least, at the very least, an annoyance and sort of, hey, why do you kind of disrespect me like that? That sort of vibe was really definitely present there from Hitler towards Ernst.
Yeah, but the third act, I think, reveals that Hitler also looked down on Rom the entire time, right? He considers him a narrow mind, and that's what's very interesting to me. I don't know if you have your copy, Rich. You want to read out Hitler's speech, or maybe I should do it.
On the beginning of Act Three,
Towards the end of Act Three, where basically Hitler says that Ernström had a very limited mind, and that's why he had no imagination, and that's why he could not foresee his own death. People, you should be donating, and there is some discussion about what kind of boot Italy is in the chat. Well, yeah, people are making fun of. Apparently, my feet are shaped like Italy, indeed, with a hangnail to represent Sicily. And but no, I do not wear stilettos, so I'm Italy without Lecce. And from what I understand about Lecce, Italy would be better off without that region anyway. So just do carry on.
I don't see where it that starts.
Okay, I'll just read it out then.
Okay.
Because I have the electronic
Oh,
copy,
I
it's
don't have
much
the
easier.
electronic. That's part of the
Right.
problem. Okay.
We have Hitler saying here that he agrees with Röhm. Röhm said at least one thing that struck the right chord. He used to say, Ernst is a soldier, Adolf is an artist. Each time he said it, I was angry. But as I think about it now, the word artist that he used with some pity begins to have far greater dimensions than his simple mind could have imagined. He had only dreams but no imagination, so he did not notice that he was going to be killed, and he couldn't be completely cruel to others. His ears understood only army brass band music. He should have listened to Wagner more, as I do. He failed to grasp beauty because he made no effort to do what is indispensable in creating beauty on this earth, that is, to know the root of the beauty one perceives. Didn't you once tell me that it all depends on whether or not you can feel yourself as a storm? That is, to know why you are a storm, to know why you are so angry, why so dark, why are you so furious with so much wind and rain trapped inside you? Why are you so great? That is not enough. Why you work so much destruction, try to fell giant rotten trees while making wheat fields fertile, revive, as with God's lightning, the faces of the young men emaciated by the Jews' neon signs, and to make all the German people taste a tragic sentiment through and through. That is my destiny. And
Great reading.
that is Hitler's last big speech of the play. It's very interesting that he brings Wagner into this, because Wagner is not military music, right? It is
No.
he is a tortured artist kind of guy. You try listening to Wagner, this is not easy listening. It's not the 80s. It's I know you like your 80s aesthetics. Hello?
Yeah, I. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm
Yeah. That is probably one of the my favorite passages in the whole story. And it was actually very sad to me in a lot of ways because, the whole third act I thought was very sad because you have Hitler asking kind of how did they die? What was the he's sort of making some comments on, the SS taking their time and not doing it as quickly as he would like. And he seemed very concerned with the humanity of it all and seemed to struggle the decision a bit. And then in this passage that you just read, you really do get the tortured artist part of Hitler coming out and him sort of wanting Ernst Röhm to be better than he was. And he's not he's saying this in a way that I thought it's not he's not just kind of berating the guy, saying he could have been better and I wish he was in some other world, but he wasn't, and this is the way things have to be, and this is why. So I found that whole part, that speech and the whole act very moving because you see there's such a humanity kind of displayed around Hitler that you typically don't get in any treatments of him.
It's not just that it's a play about my friend Hitler. It's about Hitler being a friend to someone and then being forced by political machinery, right? It's like Strasser really puts it to Röhm when he's pleading with him to betray Hitler to save themselves, right? It's not that Hitler would betray you. It's just as he's been seized by this machine. And it has a will of its own. The political machine has a will of its own. And yeah, Hitler might not like betraying you, but he will do it because he is a political animal, whereas you are a simple soldier, or worse yet, a guy who thinks he's a soldier, who likes playing soldier. That's another thing that, but to me, this is actually very illustrative because I read the play and I see Ernst Röhm. He's portrayed as a bit of a thickie, right? As someone who's a very capable military leader, someone who actively enjoys this life of. And of course, I've had Josh Neal on this show, and he's written American Extremist, which is about the psychology of extremist politics. And he quotes heavily from Andrew Lobachevsky's Political Ponderology, where this, which we also discussed with Josh Neal in a separate episode of the Writer's Block, he describes the Lobachevsky describes the skirtoid, all right, the military guy who's very much out of place in peacetime, but is very vital and just simply enjoys himself in military type situations, completely lost in any other case. And I see a celebration of this kind of personality on the right. I see a resurgence, people saying, oh, you don't really need much theory or ideological framework, and you don't even need to do cultural activism as part of the right. All we really need to do is gather in large numbers and maybe march around and maybe look, good. And things will sort themselves out. You read
Yes.
into what's his name, into Armstrong's character, a combination of, well, I read into him half Wignat, half Bronze Age pervert, if I'm being completely honest. That's the composite which forms Armstrong's character. Of course, there's the aspect of Armstrong being a homosexual and very openly so. This play is full of homoerotic imagery. Just most of it comes from Ernst Röhm describing how handsome soldiers are. But we should maybe address that. Maybe and there's been some criticism from Andrew Joyce in particular about what the right could gain from Yukio Mishima, who is a homosexual, let's not kid ourselves, or was at any rate. What can we gain from reading this homosexual person who has a lot of homoerotic imagery in his work? I mean, I've also read some other works by him, and no, he does not skimp on the homoeroticism. Maybe you want to address that, Rich.
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I didn't really notice it that much till you pointed parts of it out. And I think...
okay. And this Maybe reminds, I'm reading too much into this.
This reminds me of a time in high school when we were reading a separate piece and everyone was talking about how gay it was. And I remember thinking it was like this great story of friendship and not thinking it was gay at all. And then like really wondering what that meant. And similarly here, I kind of thought it was more about friendship than the homoeroticism. Or I just must have missed it. Or like it just, I must read it in a different context or something. But yeah, to be completely honest with you, I didn't think it was a big theme, but it must be for people like pointing it out.
Yeah, I mean there are some lines which I cannot locate right now, but they are about friends entering each other and steel entering supple bodies. Where can I find that? God, I'm lost in this copy because it's not quite searchable. And there is of course vivid description of veined muscles and glistening cheeks, and powerful bodies, sinew and muscle, which makes political will, and how the army, the barrack room, gets the best, makes the best of men. These are all Ernst Röhm's words. And of course, Yukio Mishima, him being a homosexual himself, he would have been fascinated, I suspect, with the figure of Ernst Röhm. There's always some form of accusation of homosexuality floating around fascism.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, and I'm thinking it is true. Maxim Gorky famously said, if we exterminate homosexuals, fascism will vanish. He intends this as basically an argument against fascism, but...
Right.
I could be persuaded to see it the other way, that actually the very fact that they can jumpstart fascism is an argument for tolerating homosexuals at the very least.
Yeah, I wonder, this reminds me of Mishima's quote about the warriors in earlier ages in Rome and Bronze Age warriors and how early they died and how beautiful heaven must have been. And this, I suppose you could read that as line as being very gay and homoerotic, but it's sort of, part of it is, well, at least in my own defense, I think there might be a lot of inherent homoeroticism apparently in aestheticism, especially talking about the human figure. And if you're very concerned with the aestheticism of your human figure, your own figure, you're into bodybuilding or that sort of thing, you know, things like that probably resonate. I mean, I'm not gay, but that idea of like dying young and leaving a beautiful body behind really resonates with me just on a purely aesthetic and romantic level. But I could see it in a slightly different context. If you are a gay man talking about that, kind of wandering at the marvel of like 20 something year old soldiers, I could see it coming that way, but I came across it and thought it was, Mishima being a bodybuilder and so concerned with aesthetics as maybe a lot of gays are, it kind of spoke to me more in that sense than being a sexual thing about other men.
Yeah, it is entirely possible. And this is a behavior observed because when you go to the gym, right, when you see the inside of a gym, you see guys admiring each other.
Right.
And not all of them are gay. In fact, many of the guys I worked out with and whose physiques I admired and they admired mine when I had an admirable physique, right? They would have punched your lights out for even bringing, ideas of gay stuff into the gym.
Sure.
But there was mutual admiration, which was grounded in aesthetics, which was grounded in recognizing the strength of another man, which is, I mean, I guess game respects game. This is something we should keep in mind.
Yeah, but it could be gay. I don't know. I might be a little bit lost on me because of the different interpretation.
Well, compared to some of Mishima's other work, and in particular, Confessions of a Mask, which is explicitly about him being a homosexual and not a very, vanilla homosexual at that. This is a refreshingly heterosexual book, even though you have moments of that. And of course, the historic Ernström was a homosexual, practiced very openly. And this was actually part of the reasons why he was bad optics for Hitler. This was still a conservative society, which was a society which was cracking down on Weimar-style degeneracy. I guess just having this guy front and center probably wasn't the best optics.
Yeah, I could see that if you were, especially if you were, rolling out these family and pronatal policies. Maybe it wasn't the best. Keep him more in the background if he's going to keep him around, possibly. But I don't know. I kind of go back and forth on that issue generally about the optics of, like, everyone thinks like they have to be married and have kids or you can't be a leader or have good optics or something. And, maybe, but there's like tons of married people with kids who are huge shitbags too. And I don't necessarily see the connection either way.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you're right there. And we've been getting donations, and I want to thank people for that. We have Slog. He has donated 14 ice creams. That's 140 lemons, and thank you for that, sir. You just delivered, right? 14-14. I don't know what that stands for, but I'm sure it's good. And Pterodactyl Beak Hat. I'm loving that name. I don't think you'd pronounce the P in English, right?
No, so you don't.
Pterodactyl Beak Hat, but I'm just going to call it Pterodactyl Beak Hat because I love the sound he has donated one ice cream, and hopefully we will one day have the R&D budget necessary to actually develop the Pterodactyl Beak Hat. It's going to push out the wide brimmed hat as the preferred garment of the pimp. I guarantee you this, and nice. We will make lots of money on a Pterodactyl Beak Hat. Thank you for that, sir. In the meantime, we can feast on your lemons and ice creams. Now, I want to take one last angle with Ernström. The way he is outmaneuvered by Hitler in the speech I read aloud, right? People who ignore the power of the artist and the necessity, I guess, for an intellectual approach, because the guy who was pure physicality, that was Rome, he was defeated, and ultimately his pure physicality of the Sturmabteilung became a liability to the National Socialist Movement. The guy who was pure intellect, Gregor Strasser, who just couldn't let go of the theory, couldn't take a victory practice, couldn't take the W in practice, and just had to keep agitating. He was completely defeated, right? And you have Krupp, the guy who thinks the character of Krupp is very interesting because he seems to have this mystical connection to iron, but we'll get into that later. And who wins is Adolf the artist, right? He has that capacity for greatness, which Strasser lacks, and Röhm lacks, and even Gustav Krupp lacks, right? He is in many ways a complete human being. Like Röhm, he was a soldier, right? He fought, he had physicality. Like Strasser, he was a theoretician, he's a thinker, he's an intellectual. And in a sense, like Gustav Krupp, he knows how to play the political game. Turns out he's even better than Krupp at the political game. all of his enemies are essentially destroyed at the end, and the guy who thought he was controlling him, well, is actually controlled by him. This is something which I think we have to understand as a movement, not just because we appreciate this book, but on a practical level, we are not going to succeed because we're just one thing. I think we have to approach, we have to be a totality of competence and proclivity as a movement, and of course as individuals, if we are to move forward. Have you any thoughts on this, Rich?
Yeah, I think that is one of the more important takeaways of what Mishima was trying to say in the whole play. And as you've mentioned before, how you thought Strom was this sort of Bronze Age wignat. You know, you see Strasser and the people who are always blabbling on and on and on about philosophy and doing endless podcasts about whatever they think this theory should be. And they're total, like, bug men. They're just like right-wing bug men, if they could even be considered right-wing. And then you have the people that think, that still seem to think, we're just going to take the streets and we just need a bunch of us. And you see that in the Rome, kind of the military gruggery, if you will, or that style of approach to politics that you see among the right wing. And then, you know, Hitler kills them both and moves forward with a mix of both. And then I almost wonder now if the line about government taking the middle route, or Hitler taking the middle route, and with Krupp saying about cutting down the left and turning the sword back and cutting down the right, if that isn't more a commentary on the kind of character Hitler had and who he was as a person and the kind of person you need to be successful in a political movement or in life, and less commentary on, you know, we need a centrist government. It seems to be more kind of getting at mixing strategies and being a complete man and not just, you know, this sort of swarmy little noodle-armed theorist, or this kind of big grug strong man with your boots are all messed up from kicking Connie's heads in. That you need maybe a little bit of both, and just one, 100% of one or 100% of the other is perhaps not sufficient for anything.
It's certainly a strange position to take. Government must take the middle road. On first reading, right, it's supposed to be this commentary about how politics always defaults to some center. But we know from history and we know from the play that Hitler is not a centrist. He's very right. Explicitly a right winger, right? People are saying, oh, he was beyond left or right. No, this was someone who's trying to conserve the German people. This is someone who's trying to conserve traditional morality. This is someone who's trying to conserve. This is a right winger. This is someone who sees his nation disintegrating and takes action to prevent that. And he also has a very solid theoretical framework from which to take action, because people are saying, oh, we don't need theory. We don't need a positive vision. How do you know what action to take? Who's your enemy? Who's your friend? What are you trying to accomplish if you have no ideology, if you have no vision for what the future should look like, right? So it's very important that you're actually strong enough to take action, but ideology informs you what actions you ought to take. This is something that's, it's very difficult to have a movement where you combine the grug brain, you know, the muscle guy with the brains guy, but they have to work together. And anyone who insists on a muscle only or brains only approach is a liability. That's something I think that should be the moral of the story here. I'm thinking that aesthetics aside, then this is an aesthetically enjoyable book. It's actually very pleasant to read. And I'm certain that if I saw a stage production of this thing, right, I would be completely blown away, especially if made by a competent director.
But I would love to see that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually had some ambitions, but they're going to be on the back burner for the foreseeable future until we can actually raise some serious funds over here. I think Mishima has given us here his idea of what a right-wing movement really should be, right? How the approach should be. Like you said, government should take the middle road, the central road. It's not a new radical centrism. It's actually tactical advice. Do not be married to these methodologies. Focus on what you're trying to accomplish and cultivate multiple competencies across domains, which might, you know, I'm saying this in maybe corporate sounding jargon, but it is, I think, the most brass tacks, bare bones way in which it could be said.
Yeah, I agree completely with everything you just said.
No,
that was my takeaway too.
Right. Well, I'm glad we agree. We have to strike this balance between the brain and the heart. This is actually, you know, pretty solid advice. It's in Plato's Republic, from what I'm being told. Apparently, this is a very special reading of Plato's Republic by Greg Johnson, that it's actually an attempt to overcorrect someone who's too much in the muscle, too much in the chest, in the tumultic areas of the tripartite soul, trying to bring him back to the head because he has an excess of chest. We have $5 from Sloopy, and he says, life is an art, war is an art. I suppose it should be no surprise that the artist succeeded. That's a very interesting angle of looking at it.
It is an interesting angle. I like that.
It gives you perspective. When you are a creative person, it gives you perspective that, you know, just intellectuals or military men maybe lack, right? Because what do intellectuals and especially academics and military men have in common? They are trains, right? They go on rails. They know how to go forward. They know how to slow down. They know how to brake. Some even know how to go in reverse. But when you're an artist, you're not riding a train, you're riding a horse. You can actually trek across rough country and you can pick your own direction, right? So, and it's actually terrifying. A lot of people have writer's block because they're terrified of all of the possible directions they can take, because they know not all directions are going to bear fruit. Now, once you face that horrible, terrifying freedom of the genuinely blank page, this actually gives you a lot of courage in the quote-unquote real world. That's, I guess, the strength of people who are creative, people who are artists, people who listen to Wagner, who can contemplate the terrifying and the tragic in ways in which people who can only handle the positive really cannot cope. I love that in the Hitler speech where he mentions that Röhm and Strasser, they had no capacity for tragedy, that his destiny is to make all the German people taste a tragic sentiment through and through, right? His work is to fell giant rotten trees while making wheat fields fertile, right? It's not something you're going to hear from someone who's focused on keeping people happy, like, or keeping them on a copium and hopium drip. It's something you would hear from someone who is prepared to take all of the black pills and turn them into strength, which is a very important skill to have if you can get it.
Yeah, and I think that is part of, you know, with the people who appreciate Hitler, well, even people who don't like Hitler, but can at least appreciate his style and procedure, that's something historically they always sort of point to. his ability to kind of inspire a nation and get people, well, to taste the tragedy and to want something more, to change the path they're on, and the ability to kind of rouse people to do that. I think that's captured perfectly in that speech in the book, or in the play here.
Yeah. It's a superpower, essentially, because Germany was pretty effectively crushed in the First World War, humiliated, the old German Empire destroyed, lost territory, and then it had the Weimar period inflicted upon it. It was constantly under threat from the Soviet Union, from these insurrections, Bavarian Social Republic, Soviet Republic, communist insurrection in the street, tranny clinics in Berlin, basically transgenderism in the 1920s and 30s. And somehow this obscure Austrian painter from Vienna found it within himself to lead people to resist that. This is not someone who was addicted to positivity. This was someone who could take defeat and turn it into a victory. It's very easy to win if you have an unbeatable army. When you have a bunch of demoralized and depressed and poorly equipped men and you eke out a victory from that, that's a genuine feat. And I guess that's the great capacity of Hitler. This is why, Germany needed an artist at the time, and I guess we need an artist now. I mean, we need all sorts of people, but maybe whoever gets this thing going off the ground is also going to be an artist. We have donations. We have 8 lemons. Well, thank you for that, sir, from Geo Brew. And unless I'm very much mistaken, Geo Brew used to be editor of what was it called? Thermidor magazine, which I read back in 2017.
Oh, nice.
And thank you for that, sir. It's one of the first distant publications I started reading. And thank you for your lemons. And we have Happy Perspective in the regular chat saying we need a gamer. Indeed we do. Indeed we do. The savior of the right race will most definitely be a gamer. I suspect it may be Hop Perspective himself. That would make for some great historical irony. That's just one of those things, I guess. And now, I want to briefly, before we conclude, you want to talk something about Krupp's romantic notions of what iron really wants to do?
Let me take a look here.
As you know, we have speeches from Gustav Krupp. They're peppered throughout the play, and the other characters kind of ignore them. That he seems to intimate that the iron, the steel in the furnaces of Krupp Works, which is still going strong, they still got a bunch of steel mills all over Germany, has a will of its own, and it does not like being made into household appliances, but that this iron's will, its destiny, is to be made into guns, into artillery, into objects of destruction, that this is the most noble position that iron can take. And in this sense, he's got echoes of that Ernst Röhm romanticization of war as well, right? But this time it's not for men, it's for the material, it's for iron itself. But we see that Krupp is a machine man. He's a man of the political machine. And I guess he's trying to abstract responsibility for things that are happening away from himself by basically assigning this agency to iron or the political machine itself, not taking responsibility, which is ultimately towards the end, Hitler takes responsibility for what he has done, for betraying his friend, and repudiates Krupp's position that, no, this is all just the machine. What's your opinion on that?
Yes, there was the part, it's after Hitler's speech that you read, when they are... So they're talking about the gunshots, I believe so. And then Krupp says, those guns are all my company's. For those who are shot, it should be a lot easier to be shot at the best performing guns in the world, the guns of Krupp Works. For those guns, too, they're shooting the real human flesh to their satisfaction for the first time in a long while. They should be able to sleep satisfied on their oak gun racks like the soldiers who have been to brothels on leave for the first time in a long while. A long time. I envy those who can sleep. And I thought that was a really interesting passage as well. And him kind of taking this pride in the fact that the guns being used, that they're hearing and kind of bring out in the Night of Long Knives are from Krupp Works. This idea that, like you were saying, they have a soul, the iron transformed into the gun has a soul. They are satisfied to be being used, you know, for the first time in a long time. They're now able to sleep kind of happily and soundly. And the sort of personification of the iron, the gun, I found it very interesting, and that it played perfectly to the idea of Krupp being an industrialist and machinist. As far as it goes for what the symbolism means, it is possible he was trying to kind of give this machine and these items a life of their own, saying this is sort of what they want, this is almost a destiny. And then you have Hitler kind of, like you said, bringing it back a little bit, saying, no, this is, you know, these are choices that we made and that we had to make. And making it, I don't know if that was it. I read that in a way where they were, Krupp was trying to make this all sort of very abstract. It wasn't, you know, we ordered people to go kill our friends. It was, you know, it was sort of the iron and the guns achieving their destiny, their fate. Yeah. I found it kind of, the way it was put, I thought it was beautifully put. I don't know if it was convincing, I guess, was my takeaway. I thought that's a really interesting take on machinery and war weaponry, but I don't know if I'm entirely convinced.
Because it reminded me of the way first Marxist and then Nick Land, who is the neo-reactionary author, describes the production process. That basically this is some sort of demonic entity self-actualizing. Mm. Marxists don't call it demonic, right? To them, it's purely materialistic, a materialist realism, right? Mm-hmm. Scientific materialist dialectics. But these processes are essentially unstoppable. They're almost automatic. You can predict them mathematically, right? The industrialists are just there for the ride. They're not making the waves. They are surfing them. They're
right, okay.
Money on yeah. this, but these processes are going to happen regardless of the people, right? And then Nick Land comes along in the 90s and early 2000s and says, well, actually, this is a sort of noumenon in the making, manifesting itself in the physical world, and people pursuing their best interest are actualizing it, right? And he says that basically the traditional economy was set up in such a way to prevent this demonic type entity from arising, but now those constraints have been lifted. Now it's happening, right? And you can see shades of that in Mishima, Gustav Krupp, as presented by Yukio Mishima. He really tries to play the Krupp family off as not owners of Krupp Works, who, you know, just make these guns and make money off of steel production, but as custodians of iron, right? And that iron itself has a will, that the industrial process itself has a kind of will, which has to be actualized. That no, it's not. I mean, this is amazing. It's a speech from Krupp. I would like to read it, right? Herum, you think capitalists are a dime a dozen and treat them all as reactionary. But at least in Krupp works has moved in accordance with Iron's will. Iron's heart,
Yes.
you see, the dream shaped by Iron, which is its president's personal wish, its president's personal wishes cannot budge. Do you think that Iron has enjoyed being made into motion picture cameras, cash registers, pots and pans, as it has been since the war? Do you think all its dreams shattered, Iron has been content being at the mercy of feckless children, women, and petty dealers? The Krupps must let Iron fulfill its own dreams at all costs. So he's not, this is not, these are not the words of someone out to make money. These are the words of a high priest of a temple of some strange god or demon, which he does not fully understand.
I think the same theme comes up in the part in Act One where Hitler and Krupp are talking about a tailor. Did you, you remember that part? And Krupp is telling Hitler that Taylor is very cautious. He can't just make a suit. He might want to make the suit, but if he can't get artistic satisfaction of the suit because the customer is not the right proportions, he might not want to make it despite wanting the money. It has to be just right. And he sees the tailor not as a merchant, but as an artist, not just as a salesman, but you know, somebody who's making art with fabric. And I think that was kind of an early foreshadowing of then the speech you read and then what comes later, of how he sees really industry. And it is an interesting, a kind of profound take on capitalism, if you will, or if it, at least on industry, the way he describes him as, like you said, the kind of the priest of this ironworks temple, or the tailor, not as just somebody who, you know, makes this, you know, trims up your sleeves and sends you on your way, but as an artist himself. And that was something that's really worth exploring and thinking on. And it has me really thinking about maybe the difference between, which is a distinction I've long thought about, the difference between maybe somebody who's a capitalist who's just wants profits at all costs versus somebody who is more of an industrialist, more of like a Henry Ford type figure or a Krupp figure. And you start to see that come out of just the way he views things. Iron and suits are not just mere trinkets and sundries to him. There's much more, and he is sort of the keeper, and the tailor is sort of the keeper of this art. He's the keeper of how iron and these weapons are produced. And there's a lot there that I don't know. I guess that's my take on it at this point, with having just read the play again last night, and where, you know, I've been thinking on it kind of a bit, but so far, you know, where my take is now is that there's an artistry to it, to even business, even to how, to making money off of something. And it's not as you said, you know, just all your capitalists are all the same, that sort of thing. And yeah, there's something profound there.
And this is, of course, the business class which the National Socialist Party actively courted, the patriotic industrialist, someone who cannot just uproot his operations elsewhere. You cannot move an ironworks with great ease. So you're sort of bound to the land if you have a production capacity, whereas if you just have a bank or a hedge fund or whatever, you can just pick that up wherever you go and move to some other place. And so industrialists tend to be more patriotic, more nationalistic than financiers and merchants. and this is, I didn't think this non-controversial. And but ultimately, we see in the end that the power relation is very clear. Hitler representing the state, representing government, which has taken the middle road, which has taken purged the militaristic element and the intelligentsia represented by Roman Strasser, is actively dominating the industrialist class. Now, the Iron gets its wish, right? But Krupp doesn't get his wish, right? Iron fulfills mm-hmm. its destiny. Gustav Krupp, he doesn't get a puppet to manipulate in Hitler. He unleashes the storm. Hitler has become the storm. And Krupp, the best he can really do is get out the way and provide the iron. And that's now people are pointing out in the chat that steel smelting is actually quite demonic activity. I've not seen steel smelted, but I've seen men who smelt steel. They are far more sunburned than people who just stare into the sun for hours. Right? They're not sunburned, they're steel burned. I guess that's that there is a difference there. It's still heat and light, but it's not the sun, and it's not anything that exists in nature, I guess. We have we are actually gone a little bit over 2 hours, Rich, so if you have any closing remarks, now's the time to share them while I check for more donations.
So My Friend Hitler is a very interesting play. It's not very long, but it's quite dense. And I would recommend everybody take a little bit of time and read it. I found it very thought-provoking, found it kind of sad in a lot of ways. I think anytime, there was this thing, this theme I was thinking about where your life is sort of your own, but not always, because you have to do things necessary, but you don't want to do. And Hitler came to that decision. And it's a very relatable decision that although he was totally in control, he sort of had no real other option. And he was a difficult one, and you feel bad about it. And I think, that was just one of the many themes there. There's the themes we just talked about production and capitalism versus being an industrialist, this idea of the left versus right and what approach to take to a political party. They're all in the same, we say left versus right, but it's like, these are all people who are national socialist. It's not like they're totally, polar opposites or anything. In some ways they are, but sure, in some ways.
Maybe
but...
it's just the narcissism of small differences with them, right?
Sure.
Because what's the ideological difference between someone like Ernst Röhm and Gregor Strasser and Hitler and ultimately even Gustav Krupp? They're
sure.
all on the same page.
Sure.
But their differences are, they're actually very important. You're going to have a national socialist government no matter what happens. But what flavor are you going to get? Are you going to get national
yeah.
Bolshevism? Are you going to get whatever Rome is planning to do? Are you going to get essentially what you had in Spain, where the corporations gradually edged out the military and the church, right? With Gustav Krupp, are you going to get what we got in real life with Adolf Hitler, which was a balanced approach to the thing? These things, when you sweep up all other opposition, sweep away all other opposition, you're going to find things to disagree over.
That's very true. That's probably a theme itself. So I would just, in closing, I would kind of, those are some of the themes. It's beautifully written, a lot of great imagery, a lot of great speeches. I found it sad in a lot of ways. And, I think everyone should take an hour or two, give it a read. And glad you asked me to do this. This was a good show. It was a little different, and I really, really enjoyed coming on talking about the play.
I know you don't like podcasting, but I'm glad you made an exception for me.
Me too.
Or the writer's block. Because, this is a I really do think we have a lot to learn from this particular play and from reading Yukio Mishima in general. We might disagree with certain aspects of the way he lived his life. I mean, he was a little bit of an Ernst Röhm. It's very obvious to me that he personally sympathizes with Ernst Röhm the most of all of the characters, although he puts so much life in all four of them, in Strasser, in Krupp, in Hitler, because he ultimately he did have his own essay, the Tatenokai, the Shield Society, and believed in this beautiful suicide, live a good-looking corpse ethos, I guess. Is what he did ultimately in his quote-unquote coup attempt, in which he took his own life. But yeah, it's a phenomenal. People should read it. Maybe one day when we are in power, or somehow, or otherwise have the facility, we will put on this show. We will do a nice high production value production. Okay, that's not real.
That would be great.
Came out all wrong, but it's all about the future, you know. And this has been the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nick Gilvey, and I want to thank Rich Hauck for being our guest tonight, for spending these 2 hours and 9 minutes with us. I want to thank everyone who tuned in live. I want to thank everyone who is listening to the replay over on Countercurrents. I want to thank everyone who commented. Everyone who donated, your efforts are what keeps Countercurrents valuable, keeps Countercurrents trucking. And I want to thank our indomitable moderators who have been completely dominating this chat tonight. I want to thank Gadius Maximus, Bartleby, and Reed Johnson. Your work is indispensable. You are what makes this show possible. Thank you for everything. Bye-bye, people.
Bye-bye. See ya.